My name is Michael Guyatt, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Join me for the roughly 50-minute time window here is Vitaly Katsanellison. I've got to know Vitaly nicely over the last year and a half, 2 years. Very thoughtful value investor and very thoughtful human being. So I encourage you to pay attention to everything he has to say here. Vitaly, for those who don't know your background, introduce yourself. Who are you? What's your background? What have you done throughout your career? What are you doing currently?
Well, I came to the United States in 1991. I was born in Russia. My day job, I'm a value investor. I run IMA, which is a value investment firm in Denver. But I also write. And I've been writing for 20 years. And I wrote for publications from Financial Times to Barron's to Foreign Policy. And my articles are published now mostly on my website, which is investor.fm. That's where you can read my articles. And I'm a diehard value investor who loves research in stocks.
Is value more subjective or more objective than growth style investing?
I think those definitions are very kind of, we use them all the time, but they're very subjective. And you can be, so value investing usually value investing, growth investing separated based on valuation. You know, if you own a stock that trades at 15 times earnings or less, you're a value investor. If you own a stock that trades at 50 times earnings or more, you're a growth investor. And I think that's how consultants most likely separate, you know, the breakup indices, et cetera, into value and growth indices, et cetera. But in the practice, it's more complicated than this because value investing is a philosophy, meaning it's an approach to investing. Like I call it, you know, kind of, there are six principles and I'll mention a few. Like you approach investing as if you are buying the whole company. So in other words, when you buy a stock, you don't look at it as just a ticker. You're analyzing it as if you're buying the whole company. So that would be principle number one. Number two, when you analyze a company, when you buy a stock, you want to buy with a margin of safety. Principle number three, you want to have a long-term time horizon. Principle number four, your true risk is volatility. Your true risk is not volatility, but permanent loss of capital. So these principles, that's what makes somebody a value investor. And let me give an example. So my biggest holding today is Uber. You know, this is not a stock you would see in a typical value, like, you know, quote unquote, in the quotes, value investor portfolio. But when we bought Uber, it was statistically very expensive. In fact, it had a negative valuation because it was losing money. But when we bought the stock, we done the research and I figured out the company was undervalued. So that's what, you know, so value investors are basically trying, you know, this is where a margin of safety comes in. So this is why I'm a value investor, not because, you know, I buy stocks at 7 times earnings. I'm a value investor because I adhere to certain principles in my investing process.
And a lot of that, I think, has to do with having a legitimately long time frame, right? Because if you're going to be if you're going to have a long-term mindset, you want to have things which, to your point, have a margin of safety because between now and a very long time frame, a lot can happen.
No, that's exactly right. Yes. No, you're not a buy and hold investor, but you're buy and sell investor, but, you know, but ideally you'll be buying stocks and owning for a long time. And you have the attitude is like kind of, I'm going to buy this company and I'm going to own it for a long time. If things change, I'll sell it. If it becomes fully valued or if I was wrong about fundamentals, et cetera. But yes, you want to be a long-term investor.
Now, I think the other challenge to this is at some point, you know, I think the hope for every value investor is that whatever they're investing in becomes overvalued, right? Because obviously making a lot more money. But there is a little bit of discipline issue there because when something is running away and it becomes overvalued because price is expanding faster than earnings, you don't really want to sell it. Because it's working, right? Momentum's in your favor. And that I think makes it challenging to adhere to a discipline. So how do you think about when those stocks in your portfolio are really starting to run away and you're starting to question the valuation, what to do about it?
Well, so if say, so there's several ways to deal with that. It depends on the company. So let's say you have a company, I'll give you two different, you have a very stodgy, slow growing company, and then you have another opposed to kind of a high growth company that has high growth rate, like Uber, for instance, right? With the first one, I would start selling it in larger chunks. And by the way, just to want to clarify something, when we are in the stock market, we deal with numbers. And so when you buy a company and you think it's worth $500, well, it's really, you know, you have to put a number to it, but it's really a range, right? It's maybe between 450 and 550, right? You know, so let's say at 450, I'll sell it, you know, the slow growth company. Maybe it's at 450, I'll sell a third. At 500, I'll sell another third. And if it gets to 550, then I'll sell the rest. So I'll be selling a, kind of a large chunks. With a company that has a high growth runway, I may be selling it in a smaller chunks. And it will be maybe, in 10 or 15 or 20% chunks. And I also under no illusions that I will sell at the top, because you don't know, right? Great example. We used to own Twilio and we bought it 25. I think I sold one third, maybe at 70, another 20%. Like basically we sold it from, I don't know, from 70 to 120. The stock went up to 400 or something, before it crashed to 45. So I had zero regret that I did not sell everything at 400, because when it was trading, when I sold at 120, I thought I was already getting a lot more than it was, company was worth. So you have to be comfortable that you're not going to mark the top, because at the end of the day, you want to be rational. When you bought let's say you thought a company was worth $1, you bought it for 30 cents and it gets to $1, and it's now it's traded $1.10, you're already living in borrowed time. So if it gets to 130, and are you going to bet this is going to get to 150? Well, now you just, just another speculator.
Right. And I would think that part of being a value investor is being excited for economic contractions or recessions or bear markets, because when fear takes hold, nobody cares about valuations, which creates even greater dislocation.
Oh, absolutely. You have to be comfortable being contrarian. And I got to use the word contrarian very select, very cautiously, because what I mean by this is really just being an independent thinker. So you may analyze something and come to the same conclusion as everybody else. So you, at this point, you're like contrarian because you're going to agree with this conclusion everybody else came up with. At the same time, you can do your analysis and realize that everybody else, your analysis is wrong and it does not, your analysis with everyone else. So at this point, you should be able, if you've done a good research, you should be able to be comfortable doing the opposite of what everybody else is doing. And to be a successful investor in the long run, you need to be comfortable kind of being in minority, kind of being being on the other side of the trade where the majority disagrees with you.
I think that brings us to the topic of the energy space, which, a lot of these energy stocks have a lot of free cash flow. We've been undervalued, you can argue, for some time relative to the very long secular case for oil and gas. More oil, I would argue, than gas, but we get into that. But that point about being a contrarian, I think, is important, right? Because energy was the standout performer throughout 2022, and you needed to be contrarian to sell, and rotate in 2023 because it was a visible performer then.
I look at oil, and the way I look at oil is this: think from supply and demand. From the demand perspective, until probably yesterday, people believed that electric vehicles will are the future and they will displace internal combustion engine cars. By the way, I think it's still going to happen, but it's going to take a long time for this to happen. And yesterday, we saw interesting news on this front when Hertz announced that they're going to they bought 100,000 Tesla vehicles and they'll be selling 20,000 of them as demand is not there. And you also start seeing how big five or big three are basically saying there's a lot less demand for their electric cars than they expected. And Tesla probably going to have the same issue. I think what we've seen happen is that early adopters like myself already bought electric cars. And so the adoption going forward is just going to be slower. And I think a lot of it is going to depend on charging stations, just because even though for 90% of Americans, that's really not an issue, but it's still the range anxiety is still there. And the reason I'm saying I shouldn't say 90% of Americans, for 67% of Americans. And what I mean by this, I think two-thirds of Americans live in a house. And if you live in a house, you basically have your own charging station in your house, right? If you live in an apartment, then it becomes a bigger issue for you to charge a car. But anyway, so my point is this. On the demand side, I think the demand for oil will continue to rise unless we have a recession, and then it will decline a little bit, not much. But so on the demand side, I'm a lot less concerned than everybody else about that. Supply side is actually, I think we're going to have issues there, because I think oil prices were already low before the pandemic. and then pandemic made it worse. And investment, and therefore lower prices usually means that, you know, the companies will invest a lot less in the supply. That's number one. Number two, all companies were basically villainized by politicians and by ESG crowd. And there are a couple consequences. Number one, politicians basically say, you know, kind of threatening windfall profits if oil prices go up. So if you're an oil company and you're basically thinking, okay, so if oil prices go up above 100, I only get to keep $100, then a lot of projects become uneconomical. And if you talk, you know, we talk to a lot of oil companies, and they're all going to tell you that they will be investing in kind of a low hanging fruit, kind of a small projects, but then they won't be making, you know, $10 billion investments in new oil fields just because it's too risky. And therefore, a lot of them are either buying their competitors or returning money back to shareholders. And also ESG also made them evil. So you have, if you are a mutual fund run, you probably, a lot of them now have mandates that they cannot invest in oil companies. So the capital became more expensive. And finally, and this is very important, the enrollment of students, you know, pursuing petrochemical degrees is, you know, it's been going down for years. So you have a fewer petrochemical engineers entering the field. So you just have less talent, you know, in, you know, kind of. So the supply will be challenged for a long time. That's kind of, so if you look from, you know, demand is going to be stable, growing a little bit, and supply will be constrained in the long run, I think. So oil stocks look to me, you know, like a good place to be. You have to be, you know, very careful. I mean, so it's, okay, when you invest in this sector, you got to be careful because it's very important to own companies that are not just good at, well, number one, you want to own companies that have a low-cost producers, right? So in other words, if oil prices do decline and stay at low levels, they still make money. Number two, you want to make sure they have good balance sheets. And number three, and this, you know, three, which is, you know, it's run by good management that is not just good at kind of running the business, which is important, but also good at capital allocation, because like this is a very cyclical industry and you can either create value and take advantage of the cyclicality, or you can be destroyed, you know, or you can destroy value. A lot of oil companies kind of buy high and sell low, like, you know, and so they just need a lot of them destroy value because they make expensive acquisitions at the top and they have horrible balance sheets, you know, et cetera, you know, when the top's the time, et cetera, you know. Times are tough. So anyway, that's my thoughts on oil.
Okay, now to play devil's advocate, right? A lot of the arguments, which I don't disagree with on any of that, you know, admittedly, they've been said for a while, right? And like I said, in some years like 2022, it works. And other years like last year, it doesn't. Do you need to have some kind of definable catalyst for things to really kind of, you know, properly get noticed by the marketplace? Because otherwise, if everybody knows the same story, you can argue there's really not much you can do with that.
Well, so in all fairness, like we haven't bought it. Like, so I own these companies today, but I haven't bought a stock last 6 months because as of right now, everybody's, you know, like this is my explanation why we own them, but I would not say I would put much money today in that space just because, you know, you are right. They, you know, they have appreciated plenty of last year, right? So but I'm a long-term investor. And so it really comes down to what is the company worth? And then you make your assumptions. What do you think the oil price is going to be for the next 10, 15 years, right? And when we do this analysis, we're kind of punching in like $70 oil. Like this is how I get to margin of safety. In other words, if the company is still undervalued at $70 oil, then I'm interested. But I'm not betting for $150 oil. I'm just, so that's how I'm approaching it. Now, natural gas is a little bit trickier, actually, because natural gas has been, I would argue there's some time arbitrage there in the natural gas names, because natural gas prices have been kind of have declined over the last, you know, I don't know, year and a half, because we have a lot of supply in the United States and the demand is there, but the demand is in Europe. And demand is in Europe because, you know, kind of Germany and other European countries have divorced themselves from Russian natural gas. And now we're building terminals to ship LNG from the United States, you know, to Europe. And as I understand, these terminals should be coming online in 24 and 25. And as those terminals come online, our most likely the natural gas price, you know, United States will go up. You know, so that's kind of how I look at natural gas.
Yeah, and I've written about natural gas. I mean, last I checked, like the average PE of some of these natural gas stocks is like 6.
Yeah.
It's as low as Brazil, basically. Yeah.
Oh, so it's a natural gas is a slightly different story, but I'm actually more excited about natural gas today, honestly, than about oil. But yes.
Okay. Now I want to go to the name of the space around the politics. You mentioned the ESG side. I don't know if you've, you know, kind of looked at this historically. This is just kind of a question I have on my mind. But at what point did oil, gas, did energy in general become politicized? Because it seems like more and more, it's very clear, right? Republicans love it. Democrats, not so much. Even if you look at congressional holdings, there are a couple of ETFs you can track, you know, that track Democrat holdings versus Republican holdings, right? And energy is pretty much the biggest sector among the Republicans and less so on the Democrats, you know, among the smallest. What happened? What caused this kind of weird political divide?
That's a good question. I think climate change is probably the biggest politicizer here. So, and it's a kind of, you know, climate change politics. And I'm lost in about 2 weeks to get into politics, but from a pragmatic perspective, and this is all I'm going to say, I'm going to stick to pragmatism. The green, green energy sources are not very pragmatic. The reason for that, because sun power is great, but it's not, it's intermittent. So is solar energy. So is wind energy. So therefore, Germany, until recently, I think, the energy costs for Germany went up, substantially, while the CO2 it produced either stayed the same, actually went up a little. And the reason for that, because they switched to solar and wind, which is, by the way, this is kind of idiotic because Germany is a very north country that doesn't have as much sunshine as, let's say, California, for instance. Okay, but they went to solar energy. And therefore, when the sun was not shining, they had to run, coal plants, coal peak plants that produce plenty of CO2. So I think we're going to have an energy transition from petrochemicals to green energy sources. And I would argue the greenest energy source there is nuclear. But for reasons that I still don't fully understand, that's the energy source that has been ignored. Long story short, When I look at this transition, it's going to be a very long transition. It's going to take decades. And therefore, this is why I'm very comfortable with that oil and natural gas are going to be around for a long time because the transition is going to take a long time.
Yeah, no, you can see clearly uranium is getting a lot of momentum recently. But again, just for the sake of pushing back for discussion, the energy transition thing, again, everybody says that and it's a mega trend, no disagreements. But I don't know, I often wonder how that can be done properly when you have, in general, as much debt as the world has. It's not like the starting point of transition is economic surplus, right, by the governments that are pushing it. So I just wonder how that plays out in terms of the thesis longer term.
Well, I think when our country, this is a bigger theme for developed world. We live in this luxury beliefs. In other words, you would like green energy sources to be, our core energy sources. And we wish for that. And we start behaving as they are. But then reality hits us. We realize that they don't work. And so I think what's going to happen, most likely we're going to start using a lot more nuclear. And I think we're going to do this when we're going to hit the wall. Let me put it this way. Yes, we're approaching that. There was an article in Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago where ESG is becoming a dirty word. And the reason it's becoming a dirty word because a lot of money, we just threw it away, we burnt it on green energy sources. And now we look at these small investments and we are basically saying, what's a pragmatic way for us to generate energy? And I think this is where nuclear is probably going to be the most important source of energy for us going forward.
I do think, by the way, it's interesting because I've seen those headlines too, right? The layoffs happening with asset managers on the ESG departments. Yeah, a lot of these ETFs that had the ESG acronym in their names, a lot of them were really just the same exact stocks in the S&P 500, with slightly different weightings and narratives around why they actually are ESG, right? It was sort of, if you can't beat them, join them. I'm cynical. To me, it's, the ESG side of the investment world would have caught fire if it had strong momentum to begin with, and if it didn't launch in a cycle that was so dominated by large cap tech. Just because everyone just chases momentum, I think largely at the end of the day, unlike value investors, more akin to you. But that to me seems like the bigger issue. It's like, all right, you can invest based on values and beliefs, but unless there's actual performance, greed matters more than CO2 emissions, I think.
Ayn Rand has a great quote. You can ignore reality for a long time, but you cannot ignore the consequences. And I think that's exactly what's happening right now.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
Just to reset the room for the remaining 20 minutes, everybody, please make sure you follow Vitaly Katsanelson here on X. Again, apologies for starting us a bit late. I see a few people want to ask questions. Just check your DMs for those that are in the queue. I want to just coordinate on the questions. I'm happy to bring you up. And as always, this will be in podcasts under Lead Lag Live on all of your favorite platforms. One of the things I appreciate about you, Vitaly, is you, when you write more than just about markets and investing, you also get personal, right? And I get personal on social media outside of the persona and the jokes and the fucked and all the stuff that I do. But I do think that that sort of showing the humanity side is important as an entrepreneur. Because the reality is we are in a business which is very challenging in the sense that, unlike other domains in life, you can't exactly link effort to results, right? Because there's a degree of randomness and no one exactly knows the cycle they're in until several years after the cycle's already started. So value investing as a style has done poorly for the last decade. Of course, if you did some individual stocks or did some, analysis like you, maybe not so much. But I want you to talk about that as sort of a business tactic for you to kind of talk about some of your dynamics with family, what's going on in the globe outside of here's what stock you're owning.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right. When you're in high school, there was a direct connection between input and output, right? If you study very hard, you're going to get good grades. But then once you graduate and then go to college, same thing happening. But once you kind of hit real life, and let's say you start looking for a job, the connection between you're looking for a job and you get in the job, it becomes very loose. Okay. It's not direct. There was a delay that could be 3 months, 6 months. And a lot of my son is graduating from SU Boulder. A lot of his friends kind of encountered that, kind of reality of life. And the same exists in investing. I mean, I could make all reasonable decisions and the market just won't care. And market won't care for 6 months, could be 3 years. So, and you have to be comfortable with that. And I think this is important. You also have to have clients that are comfortable with that as well. So therefore, instead of us trying to go out there and to ask people to join us as clients, what I do through my writing, I say, this is how I invest. This is what I'm going to do. And if you want to join us, here I am. But I'm going to manage money this way. I'm not going to change. And if you want me to do something else, this is not a place for you. And I was lucky that we attracted, good number of clients who wanted their money managed, kind of our way. And also, and this is not it's kind of interesting. You're absolutely right. I write about life, philosophy, even classical music. And this is not this ended up helping us from a marketing perspective, but this was not a business ploy. I was not smart enough. I wish I was smart. Michael, let me just describe the newsletter. You've seen it. But imagine this. And if you haven't read my newsletters, you can subscribe on investor.fm. But imagine this. You get a newsletter that's going to have my father's painting. It's going to have a personal story. Then it's going to write up on the stock or economy, whatever. And then it's going to have my brother's painting. And a write-up about classical music with some links to YouTube. If I was creating a business plan that would just describe that, this is the newsletter that you're going to get. And that's what, you know, and that's going to be the marketing tool. Most people would laugh at me. But the reality is, I think, and again, I wasn't smart enough to do it. Like I created this because this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to write about not just investing, but I also wanted to talk about philosophy, travel. I also wanted, I love classical music. So I wanted to share my love to classical, you know, my love for classical music with others. And, but it happened to, but this is not something that many people do. And it, when people hire a money manager, they're not just hiring the person for their skills, which is very important, but they want to make sure that they are basically in bed with somebody who has a, you know, good character. And inadvertently, that was very beneficial for marketing. So I, you know, let me put it this, but let me just clarify this. If my company was closed to new investors, I would still be doing the same thing. In other words, if we could not accept new clients, I would still be writing about classical music, about my life, and about investing. So I just love what I do, and people tend to, you know, relate to what I do.
Yeah, listen, people do business with people that relate to them. Opposites do not attract when it comes to business relationships. And I will say that for those in the audience that are not familiar with the investment industry, this is one of the advantages of being in the industry, having what are called separately managed accounts, where you have a direct relationship with the client. Whereas in my world, as a portfolio manager, basically a product developer of various funds, I don't necessarily know who my clients are. I can't handhold them if I even wanted to. And unfortunately, in the world that we're in, there's no such thing as a true long-term investor when it comes to ETFs or mutual funds. Everybody often overtrades and makes mistakes and doesn't understand cycles. So that humanity aspect, yeah, I give you credit for that, Vitalik, because it's aside from the fact that you write very eloquently and very poignantly, as I've seen with some of your pieces, I think it's a lesson for those that want to be entrepreneurs to be a little bit vulnerable and reveal what they actually like and not just be all business all the time.
No, I think, you know what's kind of interesting? I think I'm kind of going back and analyzing it backwards. I wasn't smart enough to create this strategy, you know, forward looking, but I think it's important not to be doing what everybody else is doing. And I think the difference between what I do and many other money managers are doing is just, I'm doing something very different. And that's happens to click with others. So I think if I understand your question, you're asking if the dollar right now is oil is traded in dollars. And you're saying the risk is that oil will not be traded in dollars. I think that's, you know, in part, which, you know, the part of the reason why I like oil, it's a good hedge in general because of the, you know, if the oil declines, because, you know, if you look at our fiscal policy, I mean, we're running a huge budget deficit. So, I mean, we are writing, you know, basically, forget the numbers, but basically, if we did not run a budget deficit last year, our economy probably would be shrinking. And so we have produced real kind of very little real growth. In other words, so if the dollar gets weaker, oil prices will go higher. And therefore, it's kind of a good hedge for a weaker dollar in my mind, which is, I think, it's not a high probability scenario. I don't know, 50-60% probability. So that's how I look at it. But also, Saudis are most likely still going to be pricing their oil in dollars, and which is very important. So I'm not sure exactly if other, like, I'm not sure about the other, you know, obviously Saudis are not BRICS, but the kind of the local politics, you know, the kind of the geopolitics of which of those countries are, I'm not sure exactly what they're going to do. But I know China would obviously like the oil to be priced in renminbi. But I'm not sure if, and maybe when Russia sells their oil to China, it will be sold in renminbi, not in dollar. But I'm not sure if, you know, renminbi will become a reserve, you know, it's very unlikely the Chinese currency will become reserve currency. So most likely what's going to happen is that US dollar will become less dominant currency, but it's just going to be very slow and very gradual decline. Because for reserve currency, you need to have several factors. You need to have size. Very few economies have the size of the United States. You need to have political stability. And arguably, U.S. is less politically stable than it was 10 years ago, but it's still the most robust democracy. And you need to have a strong economy again. And it's a relative game. So we still have this is one of the strongest economies in the world in size. So yeah, U.S. dollar is kind of it's the worst house. I mean, it's the best house in not a great neighborhood, but it's still the best house. So that this, I hope I'm answering your question.
But no, no, but I think it's good. Actually, it's, but that does bring with it another question, which is that if you're about being a value investor international in general, I guess I mentioned Brazil earlier, right? I mean, those are, I would think, metric wise among, you know, the most undervalued. So if you have a thesis around a sector like oil, do you look for international proxies that might be even more discounted? Because I think that becomes another interesting argument for the BRICS outside of, you know, Russia, obviously, and China.
Well, yeah, well, that's a different question, right? This is like, so when we look for companies, when we say we find an attractive company in the United States, the next thing we do, we say, is there a cheaper alternative somewhere else? But if I can find a cheaper alternative in Norway or Sweden or some other developed country, that is, then I'll do that. So we'll look globally. And in fact, the oil company we own, they say, you know, we own a Swedish oil company. So because I find it to be one of the cheapest, highest quality companies out there.
I think the question is ultimately about how do you identify stability, which you can argue maybe relates to management. But, you know, there are some companies that the management has a high, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, have a better stronghold and can result in a more stable sort of growth trajectory than others.
I think I'm going to try to answer the question I understood, which is basically the importance of management. Is that the question?
Yeah. Let's go with that. Because I think that's, at least that's kind of the old school way that a lot of people would think about value investing, yeah. Right? It's actually trying to get to the manager.
So I think when you look at management in general, we always do two type of analysis, how well they run in the business and how well they allocate capital. Now, and I said this before, but I would argue when you look at companies that are very cyclical, especially companies in the mining sector, or oil and gas, whatever, just natural resources, capital allocation becomes incredibly important just because of cyclicality and volatility of the sector or those sectors and volatility of the commodity, their price takers, because, you know, oil companies sell the price at whatever the oil prices is. Okay. So like I'll pick on the gold miners, for instance. Gold miners in general, with very few exceptions, have been horrible capital allocators. Historically, they destroyed so much value because they are like, you know, my favorite story, Warren Buffett has this story that describes almost every management team in the oil and gold mining. Now, I shouldn't say like a lot of management teams in, for sure in gold mining, this old oil man dies and goes to heaven and he meets St. Peter, and St. Peter says, listen, you were actually a good guy throughout his life, but the problem is the heaven is full, so I have to send you to hell. The old man says, listen, is there any chance maybe I can convince somebody to trade places with me? And the St. Patrick says, sure. Not St. Patrick, but the guy says, sure. You know, you can, you know, right, in fact, right now we have an oil and gas conference in the heaven. So yeah. So this oil man goes to heaven, runs into this oil and gas conference and says, hey guys, they found oil in hell. And so there is this stampede of people running from heaven to hell. And this guy is running behind them. And St. Peter says, listen, you don't have to go to, you know, you don't have to go to hell. You can go to heaven. And this guy says, but what if it's true? And I think this is exactly what happens to a lot of management teams that run gold mining companies and oil mining and oil stocks. I remember, Michael, I don't know if you remember, but like, but I forget when gold reached $2,500, I forget, like 7-10 years ago, a lot of gold companies had a hedge and all of them took it off right at the top. And that marked the top for gold. So, and then, you know, and then they start to hedge again when the oil price, you know, gold price declined. So my point is when you analyze mining companies or gold or exploration companies, you need to spend a lot of time on the past, on the management decisions in capital allocation and analyze that what they have done in the past. And this is where I spend as much time as I, you know, this is where I spend a little bit, spend a lot of time analyzing, you know, when we analyze these companies. Yeah, not that. So the question is, if we have a new investor come in, do we buy the same stocks right away that, you know, that my other clients hold? We have a lot, because we run separately managed accounts, we have a luxury of basically customizing each portfolio for this, exactly what you just described. So I'll give you a real example. Today, our existing clients that have been with us for a while are probably 80-85% invested. And our new accounts are only maybe 35. If somebody comes in, becomes a client today, there would only be 35% invested, because every stock we own, we figure out what the fair value is. And then a different discount to fair value, we have different position size we want to buy. And so at a certain price, let's say we think company is worth a dollar and the stock is trading at the, you know, 85 cents to the dollar, we're not going to buy, you know, we may still hold it for an existing account, but we're not going to buy this stock for an existing client, for a new client. So there is a divergence between our existing clients and new clients. So yes, yeah, so they'd see.
Vitaly, for those who want to track more of your thoughts, more of your work, I think you mentioned the website a little bit earlier, but you know, I think, like I said, you've got a lot of interesting content. Where can people find more of your work?
Investor.fm, like FM radio, investor.fm. You can subscribe to my articles. You can read my articles there.
I think you got to start doing some podcasts, my friend. You got to be the host.
Oh, I do.
Get some thoughtful people like you.
Actually, I didn't mention, we do have a podcast, but it's a lazy man's podcast because I don't want to be doing the work like you're doing. So what it is, it's a, if you look for intellectual investor, we have a podcast where my articles are read to you by someone else. So it's kind of my articles on tape. Think about this way. Yeah. So we do have a podcast.
Everybody, please make sure you follow Vitaly. I'll have this as a podcast under Lead Lag Live on Apple, YouTube, and Spotify. Probably in a couple of days. And everybody enjoy the long weekends. I have a feeling that it'll be not so interesting for a lot of people that are tracking the crypto space, given that never closes. Thank you, Vitaly. I really do appreciate
it. It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at Lead Lag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the Lead Lag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.